ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Going to talk first up about fun and pleasure versus happiness. Love you to join this conversation. How do these concepts differ? When was the last time you had fun? And do you have a lot of fun in your life? A midlife malaise can often set in when responsibilities like family and mortgages and careers get intense, and then while you might be happy, even very happy, the fun stuff may nevertheless fall off the table. Now, we're all striving for a happy and good life, and to achieve it, we're told to focus on things like gratitude and mindfulness and staying positive. And yes, they're all mindful, they're all worthy pursuits, but what if we're missing something? And what if we've forgotten about having fun? And what if fun can make you a better partner or parent or employee or business owner? Joining us tonight is at least one professional who has focused on the importance and impacts of fun and pleasure in our lives. Dr. Desiree Kozlowski, is the chair of the academic board at Southern Cross University with primary research interests in subjective pleasure and pleasurable emotions, especially their relationship with human health and resilience and creativity and in flourishing. More importantly, in 2022, Desiree ran the National Pleasure Audit in Australia. So thanks, Desiree. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Philip.
We're hoping to be also joined by Dr. Mike Rucker a bit later on too. He's got a book out called The Fun Habit, a Behavioural Scientist, and we'll try and track him down in the United States right now. But Desiree, can we start with you? How do you see, what's the difference between, or is there a difference between fun and pleasure?
Look, I think if you speak to a bunch of people, you'll often get slightly different responses to this. So I'll give you my view, and that is that fun is a kind of subset of pleasure. So all things that are fun are pleasurable, but not all things that are pleasurable are necessarily fun.
Uh-huh.
But that they are both gorgeous things to do, and they give colour to our lives and give us that feeling that things are worthwhile.
Okay, I think have we managed to find Mike? Mike, we have Mike. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Yep. Dr. Mike Rucker is a behavioural scientist, and he's written a book called The Fun Habit. Mike, you're with Dr. Desiree Kozlowski tonight. Can we start with you as well, Mike? What do you think the difference between fun and happiness is?
So for me, I really look at happiness as something in the rearview mirror, especially with regards to science. We sort of boiled it down to this idea of subjective well-being, so we've almost quantified it. And because of that, right, because all of these are essentially, you know, syntax constructs that we develop, right, we've made it into this thing where it's an act of rumination, you know, where we're comparing ourselves to our neighbors or our circumstance in life. And what we now know, especially from a psychological standpoint, is that when we get folks kind of stuck in that rumination of, am I happy? They essentially waste that energy instead of enjoying all of the fun things that life has, right? And so the distinction for me is happiness is sort of this rear view, you know, lagging indicator of, you know, how you're enjoying yourself in life, where fun is really this act of mindfulness, because any of us can have fun and change our circumstance essentially in any given moment, right? I'm going to go and do something that I enjoy. And we know when you take that action-oriented approach, a bunch of fun, you know, interesting things happen, right? One, you're just enjoying yourself. Two, this idea of social determination theory, you're reminding yourself, you know, even when things are going bad, in the book I unpack, you know, kind of losing my younger brother suddenly, we still have the agency and autonomy to change our circumstance. And then three, now we're doing something instead of ruminating, right? And so we know poor mental hygiene kind of comes from the state of introspection, especially if we're, you know, kind of stuck in negative thoughts. But when we're engaged with friends, pro-social behavior, things that we enjoy, time with our partners, we kind of crowd out that time, you know, where we sit and kind of what in psychology we say, you know, wallow in negative valence. So That's the main distinction. One is this action orientation towards things that we can do that are pleasurable, and the other is essentially an active evaluation, you know, looking back at our life and are we, quote unquote, happy?
Mm. Desiree, some might say, look, you know, the difference is surely that fun is essentially fleeting and trivial, and, you know, the fun you have when eating an ice cream, for example, and that happiness is something more profound and deep and abiding. For example, raising children mightn't always be fun, but it often, well, maybe invariably, is a source of happiness to people.
Yes, look, much of that is true, and all of it is subjective.
Right.
but I kind of agree with Mike in this idea of happiness being a rear view thing. So it's not so thinking that we're happy or feeling happy is a great thing. Nobody's saying don't go for that.
Yeah.
But and fun can be fleeting and frivolous and just serendipitous and you know, be gone the next moment. But not all fun is like that. And we have a kind of a bank, you know, like an energy bank or a bank of vitality. And I think that doing fun things is making a deposit that we can draw on when the kids are screaming and we haven't had any sleep for 4 days. You know, this is, we can't just do one thing and not the other. We have to sort of look at ourselves as human animals that want meaning and want enjoyment and want beauty. And the idea is to kind of expand our experiences there. I think Mike and I would probably agree quite strongly on most of that.
Hmm. Desiree, in 2022, you ran a thing called the National Pleasure Audit, which sounds like it would have been a fun piece of research. I don't know. I don't know whether it brought you any fun or happiness, but tell me, what was it and what did you gauge?
So what I wanted to do was get a snapshot of this, and this was just the National Pleasure Audit in Australia.
Mm.
And we're hoping to sort of spread this to other countries if they're interested. Oh, Mike, you might want to help out with that in the US. But what we wanted to do is take a snapshot or an audit of people's pleasurable lives. And we found out a bunch of great things, and we followed it up with a little extra research last year, and we're doing some more now. So, you know, we wanted to know, what is it that Australians regard as most pleasurable?
Mm-hmm.
We also want to know, what is it that they actually do? So we've asked two questions. One, what do you think are pleasurable things and the most pleasurable things? And two is, where have you got the most pleasure in the last couple of weeks? And those things are subtly different in their answers. We also asked about a bunch of emotions, pleasurable emotions, and, you know, what are people's favourite pleasurable emotions to feel? So, for example, what do you think is the thing that Australians regard as most pleasurable?
What do I think? What do I think the answers would be? The most pleasurable thing, I don't know.
I'm putting you on the spot. Sorry.
It is, because it is it's hugely subjective, isn't it? See, I would say spending time with your kids, I guess, would be the most pleasurable thing. I mean, that's for me, but I'm not raining on anyone's parade here. But but I mean, I don't know what people would answer. You tell me, what was the answer overwhelmingly?
So the number one thing that people regard as pleasurable is spending time in nature.
Uh-huh. Okay.
The second one, which I thought was, it just gave me enormous pleasure to see what came in at number two, because most people think it's going to be sex, right?
Yeah. I'm thinking it has to be in the top five here or somewhere, surely, but go on.
It's humour.
Uh-huh.
So the second most pleasurable thing that Australians rate is humour. And then it's music. Yeah. And then it's reading. Then it's spending time alone.
Yeah.
Pets come in there.
Yeah.
And sexual activity comes in at a number 10. So we do like
Gee
it.
Gee whiz.
Yeah, I know.
Gee whiz. It's not...
when we talk about where do Australians actually get their pleasure, and what we did was ask in the last 2 weeks,
yeah,
to what extent has each of these things been a source of pleasure? The number one source of pleasure for Australians is pets. So that's where they're getting most pleasure from. Wow. It's a more accessible thing to do. And when we rank there, sexual activity comes in at number 16.
So something's
time in nature.
Do we need to give out Dr. Alex Comfort's books again, Desiree? Because something's gone wrong here.
It's not wrong. It means that we're getting pleasure from a range of stimulus or experiences, and I thought it was gorgeous. And there's all kinds of wonderful things, including, and Mike will be happy about this, engaging in playfulness with others, relationships with friends, with our intimate partners, that's high on the list, and spending time with children is high on the list of where Australians are getting their pleasure as well.
Mm. Mike, this is Dr. Desiree Kozlowski with us, Chair of the Academic Board at Southern Cross University, and she ran a national pleasure audit in 2022. This is serious research, people. And, well, you just heard some of the findings from it. Mike Rucker is a behavioural scientist and author of a book called The Fun Habit. And we're talking about the differences between fun and happiness and pleasure. Mike, are you surprised by those findings? And do you think in the United States they'd be replicated?
Yeah, they essentially have. So, you know, not with the lens of specifically looking at pleasurable activities, but, you know, various time use studies have been done, and that's fairly in line with what you would see in North America as well. I think, you know, there's always this kind of distinction, you know, no fun but all joy. And so a researcher out of Harvard by the name of Dan Gilbert wrote an amazing book called Stumbling on Happiness that kind of unpacked, you know, some similar findings. And essentially, I think sometimes in retrospect, you know, there was certainly purpose and enjoyment with some of the things that you've talked about. But when you know, honestly answer what are things that I would like to do all the time and have those indexed in my life, you know, things like walking in nature, you know, engaging in friendships, you know, are at the top of the list. And then, you know, the devil's always in the details, right? I mean, you know, yes, sex is very enjoyable, but it's not something you essentially want to, or most of us would want to do, you know, consistently day after day after day. It's something that we think about episodically with someone that we love. And so, you know, all of these things become important. The contribution that I'd like to add too is that we know that they are important. There's this concept that called the hedonic flexibility principle. And it essentially says that if these things are devoid in our life, that ultimately we suffer the same consequences as something like sleep deprivation. So just circling back to, you know, something that you had said to Desiree, this idea, yeah, well, fun, you know, oftentimes is wrongfully framed as being whimsical or something that's not important. We know folks that don't do the things that Desiree had explained. So essentially, they're looking at their life as unfun, are paradoxically also some of the most unproductive people, oftentimes find themselves in a downward spiral, where instead of looking for those things that could actually fill their fun cup, they instead engage in poor forms of escapism because they're really just trying to displace that, you know, personal pain or discomfort, or sometimes even just low-level boredom. So, you know, in that context, making sure that these things that people want to do are, you know, incorporated into their life becomes extremely important so that the rest of their life can thrive.
Robin says, Desiree, I totally agree with your top 10 happiness, although Keith wants to know what question you asked, and Keith also wants to know, did you do your survey at a convent?
Keith just wants to big note himself.
That may be true. Maybe true, and who doesn't?
Exactly.
It does illustrate something, though, doesn't it, Desiree? That that because this is a truer reflection than you know the world of advertising and media and what we're supposed to want, for example, would suggest. I mean, we're supposed to want beauty and attractiveness and, you know, in subset sex, I suppose. But this would indicate that although people don't not want it, it's in there with a whole lot of other things and nowhere near the number one.
Absolutely. And, you know, how much time could you spend looking in the mirror if you're gorgeous? Mm. Like, yes, it I'm sure it gives pleasure in some ways, but, you know, it doesn't feed our spirit in the way that we're talking about. And one thing, you know, we can laugh and this is all good fun and nice to talk about, lovely to think about. But, you know, what we found was very strong relationships between drawing pleasure from these things in our lives and, you know, subjective well-being, physical health, good mental health. So although we need to be conscious that these relationships can be bi-directional so that if we're feeling good, we can do more pleasurable things, but without doubt, when we do more pleasurable things, more fun things, it boosts our subjective well-being, if you want. It is associated with improvements in all kinds of outcomes, including things like immune response and resilience. So these are things that the fun things, and I think we shouldn't kind of denigrate words like whimsical or frivolous. These are beautiful things in our lives and give us the lightest moments and are the best antidote to doom scrolling and fixating on sort of threat stimuli or, you know, the horrible stuff that we're reading in the news. Without this kind of thing, we really are not able to enjoy the full richness of what being human can be.
Mike, taking the point of just exploring that point of triviality for a second too, are there certain ages when more fun is being had? I mean, obviously, little children are all about fun, but do we associate fun? I think we do, don't we? We sort of associate fun with kids and young people more, assuming that they actively do things for fun, for example, whereas adults probably do it less. Are there certain ages when more fun is being had, or is this just a myth? And is it also untrue that we forget how to have fun the older we get?
So unfortunately, there are nuances of truth in everything that you just said. You can Google this concept of the U-shaped curve of happiness. And so we do know that, and I meant inherently, we can understand why, right? When kids and the aging well tend to have more autonomy, they have what we call time affluence, which essentially means they have more control over how they can spend their time. And when you have more control over how you can spend your time, you tend to have more power to integrate things that you enjoy doing, right? There's also this concept in North America, but I assume it applies in Australia as well, of the sandwich generation, right? So for the first time sort of in human history, you know, we have parents that are living longer, which is a great thing, but we still need to take care of them. And we're also having kids older than we have in previous generations. So we now have a lot of adults who are taking care of not just their children, but their parents. And that, you know, means that we have duties that essentially crowd out that 168 hours we have in a week. But the thing is that once you become mindful of that circumstance, oftentimes you can either reframe what you're doing or, you know, figure out how you can still accomplish what you need to accomplish in an enjoyable way. And so, you know, as they say, knowledge is power, right? And so once you kind of look at, like, you know what? Yes, I have allowed my life to habituate in a way that isn't that enjoyable. But if I made a few changes, you know, this time with my kids that, you know, initially I looked at, I have to do this because I essentially need to take care of them.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, I used to love soccer. So why don't we go to the pitch and, you know, play soccer together, something that I can do with them that's active leisure rather than, you know, sitting on the sidelines and watching them do it. So to answer your question, yes. And it primarily has to do with the fact that, you know, between 30 and 50, we have a lot less time than we used to with regards to our ability to have fun. But there are a lot of things that we can do to change that circumstance.
Mm. Yes. Desiree, just back to the survey, which is completely fascinating.
Good.
Who's having the most pleasure?
Look, I haven't looked so much at age yet. This was a lot of data for me sitting there in my little room all by myself, and I'm getting a little team together now. We had around 3,000 responses from all over Australia. There are differences for groups, but what it looks like, and again, this is just preliminary sort of quick and dirty analysis, as we say, is that we also looked at the ability to savour, and I always like to talk a little bit about savouring, which is bringing all of our attention to something that's pleasurable in the moment. And this is something that intensifies the benefits of pleasurable activities. And we found that although older people tend to do fewer different activities, they are better at savouring. So they suck all the juice out of the good things that they do. So we, you know, just like we're not quite as quick thinkers as we get older, but we have this incredible sort of encyclopedia to draw upon, so it evens out the differences a little bit. I think we're likely to see something like that with older adults. But, yeah, again, you know, some of our research has indicated that U-shaped curve and the pressures that are there in sort of, you know, as we come into full adulthood and have those demands on our time. But, you know, there's plenty of people out there having all kinds of fun, and not all of it is sexual. So there we go.
No. Well, in fact, not all of it. It's not even. That's right. It's kind of exactly. In the top 10, but only just.
Mm-hmm.
who is not having any pleasure or fun?
Look, there are people who have difficulties with experiencing pleasure. The old-fashioned way of talking about this is to say people experience anhedonia, which is an absence of pleasure. This is a primary symptom of things like major depressive disorder, schizophrenia, and a bunch of other things. But the most recent research indicates that in many cases, it's not the ability to experience pleasure that is impacted. It's actually the motivation to seek it in the first place. So behavioral activation, or just doing it because, you know, because you should, can lead to improvements there. So there's promise even clinically for these kinds of interventions and sort of intentionally building simple and rational pleasures into our day.
You say rational, and Mike, I'll get your view on this too. We all know the expression, oh, I've got a guilty pleasure, which implies, and I don't know, maybe this is a hangover from religion in the sense that having fun is not supposed to be the thing you're doing. You're supposed to be adhering to the religious tenets you were taught. But is the idea is the problem that some people have about having fun is that they regard it as, in quotes, guilty. They really shouldn't be having fun. There's something wrong about it. It's a sin in some ways. Is that it?
And I definitely think Mike will have something to say on this too. But you know, just when I started this kind of research, which was 10 years or so ago, nobody used the word pleasure. It was all positive affect and, you know, positive emotions. And
yeah.
And I just think, what rubbish to think that one emotion is positive and one's negative. You know, life is a magical, rich mix and mess of all of this stuff that, that gives us our color and our texture and makes everything worth sort of jumping into. So I personally don't like this idea of some pleasures are worthy, and so we're allowed to sort of do those, and you know, we're allowed to help the little old lady across the road, but we're not allowed to say that felt good. We're supposed to just do it for the little old lady, and you know, I think that this has all had its day. We know science is telling us, you know, very clearly that those ideas are not correct yeah. and not helpful. So I think that embracing our own pleasure and talking more about pleasure should definitely be on our agendas. I think at the moment in society, people get more kudos for saying, oh, yeah, I work till midnight, I only got two hours sleep, I work 7 days a week. Oh, good on you. No, you're an idiot. This is your life you're wasting.
What do you think, Mike? You come from a country which is pretty heavily drenched in religious observance. Is the idea of pleasure and fun being tainted by this, do you think, or not?
Yeah, essentially, I think what needs to happen is a marketing campaign, right? If you look at the history of the word, you know, having a bit of fun with someone was pulling a prank, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So Desiree's spot on. I mean, there's a couple things there, and I'll make them quick because I could go on 30 minutes about this. But in my research, essentially, it's been two things, right? It is that, you know, Puritan Protestant work ethic that's sort of been entrenched in our social norms. And then also this idea that we equate, right, time as money. And so for some, that sort of mental frame that if somehow I'm not being productive within a block of time, that my self-worth or there will be some sort of financial consequence. And again, we know that's simply not true. And I love the analogy against sleep, because I would argue, I don't know in Australia, but with folks like the Huberman Lab out of Stanford here in the States and others, and even staunch folks that used to advocate for productivity like Gary Vaynerchuk, they just won't tell you to be sleep deprived anymore. Because we know now, you know, with 30 years of rich research, that the idea of not having good sleep hygiene, you know, at least getting 7 or 8 hours of sleep, means that in 2 or 3 weeks, you're going to fall off
you're
a cliff.
You're going to fall off a cliff, exactly. Let me jump in for a quick second here, Mark, because I just need to welcome some other listeners to the program as we put together this truly national audience here.
This is Nightlife with Phil Clark
on ABC Radio.
You're with me, Philip Clark, on Nightlife. We're right across the country. If you've just joined us, we're talking about fun and pleasure and happiness with Dr. Mike Rucker. He's an American organizational psychologist and author of the book The Fun Habit, and also Dr. Desiree Kozlowski, who's chair of the academic board at Southern Cross University and ran just a completely fascinating thing called the National Pleasure Audit in 2022. So I'd love to hear from you too if you have fun in your life and what do you do for fun, how you regard it all. 2-1-300-800-222. There are lines free. Sorry, Mike, you were talking here about the connection between guilt and fun and guilt and pleasure.
Yeah, and I think it's just unfortunate. There definitely seems to be a gender bias here, right? In the research that I've looked at, I think because, you know, and I'd love Desiree's opinion on this, but, you know, the nurturing aspect of being a mother, oftentimes, you know, that exchange, even if we're talking about 2 or 3 hours of their 168, you know, this idea that I might be taking away time, you know, from taking care of my parents or the family unit, can, you know, unfortunately create this dark cloud. But again, when I'm helping folks, especially kind of in the throes of burnout, I'm reminding them that's similar to sleep, that we know through the hedonic flexibility principle, if you're not filling your fun cup at least you know, with some things that you enjoy, ultimately what happens is, one, you don't have the vigor and vitality to actually do the things that you feel like you have to do. But then, you know, this other area that's not talked about enough, a lot of my academic research has been with physicians, is that you start to lose empathy because the world is sort of bleak, right? And yeah. Once you lose empathy for the ones that you serve, ultimately you lose that connection. So you wonder why you're even doing that. And you really find yourself in this downward spiral. So we're not talking about a life of whimsy, right? We're not trying to prescribe, you know, go out to Burning Man, you know, for the rest of your life. We're really just talking about recalibrating that balance so that you do have things to look forward to, because we all have slings and arrows that come at us, right, at all times. And so when we're creating moments of micro joys, instead of just sort of mortgaging, you know, our leisure activities for that one big event each year that might go sideways anyways, when times are tough, we have something to look forward to. Mm. And as Desiree had already mentioned, I'm a big believer in savoring too. There's this form of savoring called dispositional gratitude. And when we know that we have the power to create these fun things in our lives, but yet we have a terrible day at work, we can put our minds there, right? And so these temporary escapes, we don't want to escape all the time because that can get ritualistic. But when we do have these tough periods, we can be like, you know what, I'm going to get through this, and then I can't wait to see my friends, or I can't wait to play the guitar, or I can't wait, you know, for movie night with my my loving partner or whatever it is. But when we don't have those, life starts to seem like we're on a hamster wheel, and it can get bleak quickly.
Yeah. Let's talk about work, can we? I mean, Mike, you're talking to us from the United States, which is, you know, in a way, one of the most work-obsessed countries on the planet. It's at a particularly in professional circles. You know, work's highly valued. Taking holidays is not. In fact, I think generally people in the States don't get that many holidays.
We're second to last with regards to giving access to leisure, which is so sad. I think Micronesia is the only country worse than us.
So where does that come? Where does that come from, Mike?
Again, it comes down to that work ethic and, you know, this sort of maladaptive social norm of the American dream. And we know that it's problematic. I mean, it's so problematic, right, that you're finding Fortune 500 companies actually incentivizing folks to take their vacation because they know that if folks don't, ultimately they're gonna burn out. I mean, here in the States, again, you know, the primary vocation that I study is physicians, and 40% of physicians right now say they don't want to return the next year. That's gonna be, you know, heading for disaster here fairly quick if we don't figure this out. And so, you know, we understand the problem, but, you know, we now need safety rails. one of the other big issues is knowledge work, right? So after the advent of the BlackBerry, we didn't have true transition rituals from our work life to our family life. So it used to be, even if we had a tough day, we knew it was over at 6 p.m. But now we can be answering emails till our bed hits the pillow.
Exactly.
And so figuring out these safety rails to protect at least some time so that people can access, you know, enjoyable activities under that guise becomes extremely important.
Yeah. We're talking about fun and happiness and pleasure with a couple of most intriguing guests here. Dr. Mike Rucker is an author of the book The Fun Habit. He's an organizational psychologist speaking to us from the US. And Dr. Desiree Kozlowski is the chair of the academic board, and she ran the National Pleasure Audit, no less, in 2022. Ron from Kiama. Hi, Ron.
Good evening to you all. Just a quick one.
Yeah.
Years ago, Tony Delroy ran the same topic as you're running tonight, and his guest of the evening had a fairly amazing single-sentence observation of happiness. Mm. In fact, it applied to contentment too. Mm. Anyway, his summary was, happiness is wanting what you have, not having what you want.
Yeah. Does that, any of that make sense to you, Desiree, or not?
Yeah, yes, it does, actually, because the way I conceptualize happiness is really about expectation and satisfaction. So, you know, if we expected to be rich and famous and married to a movie star, we're not going to be happy with wherever it is that we find ourselves. But if we look at what we have, we look at it with gratitude, we nurture it, and we bring some humour and playfulness to it, then suddenly it's looking a lot brighter.
Hmm.
So, yes, I'd agree with that, at least to some extent.
Yep. Mike, let's talk about work. In a work sense, obviously some jobs seem more fun than others. A dental hygienist isn't necessarily one job I would put on the fun list. But according to your research, you were introduced to a dental hygienist called Judy. Tell us about Judy and what she has to teach us about having fun at work, because I'm thinking a dental hygienist is not top of my list, but go on.
Yeah, I mean, she is an amazing story in the sense of, you know, being able to take your power back, right? So just the short version of her story is she was a divorcee. She needed to find a vocation that would allow her to still, you know, be a single, you know, a successful single mother, but, you know, paid okay. So she went into that vocation without much research. And when she entered it, she realized that she was the worst part of most people's day, right? Because, you know, most people don't like to go to the dentist. So just through happenstance, one day she wore a silly costume and she realized that everyone that had left the dental chair that day left with a smile and was just like, thanks for brightening my day. So she took that kernel of an idea of just having fun at work and kept going and going and going to the point where she realized she was making a true impact. Folks that would come in there and need nitrous oxide because they were so full of anxiety to get dental work done, didn't need it anymore. People were actually looking forward to going to the dentist. Folks that would go only once every couple of years, you know, would actually now go twice a year because they wanted to see her. And she obviously enjoyed it more because instead of, you know, watching people time after time, you know, essentially be unhappy in the presence of her, they were now the best part of, she was the best part of their day. And so it's just a shining example of how you can take most circumstances and essentially change them. But one thing I would like to kind of add that I've found interestingly kind of the most important is making sure that you take breaks, even if that's just your lunch break. Because especially here in North America, so many people, again, you know, this fallacy of being productive, think that if they just grind it out through their lunch hour, that they're going to be somehow more productive. But we know that by looking at time use studies, that the folks that don't take a break to kind of enjoy themselves, you know, as a respite, paradoxically aren't doing much the second half. But the ones that might go out and have lunch with a friend and not talk about work for an hour and enjoy nature and the sunlight and having a coffee at, you know, kind of a bustling cafe, they come back recharged and are so much more successful with regards to not just productivity, but also there is some empirical evidence to suggest that they're a lot more creative as well. So it's not just about having fun at work, but also making sure that you're integrating fun throughout your day, you know, within a work environment.
Okay, Michael Rucker is with us from the United States. We're talking about fun and pleasure and happiness. Hi, Leroy.
How you going?
Not bad. What's your idea of fun?
Well, Michael sort of nailed it in the sense, I reckon when you're born, you want food, and that makes you happy.
Mm-hmm.
Then after that, you want to have fun. You play with toys. And then after that, you want to find some pleasure. Then you seek happiness from what you learn from your pleasure. And you hope in the end that you are content. Now, during that journey, you may take lots of steps into trades or work or making people happy or maybe a religion or something. But that's the journey of life is food, fun, pleasure, happiness, and to be content. And I hope. And when you first started this talk tonight, I was with you, and then you started talking about people's jobs and whatever. Some people trying to find happiness through money. Other people find happiness through another version. And that at the end of the whole story is you just like to be content.
Hmm. Thanks, Leroy. Desiree, back to you. Do you think we should be aiming to have pleasure at work, or should we Because some people get disappointed that they don't like the work, for example. And look, sometimes work is just one of those means to an end occupations, which, you know, for people is enough. Should we be aiming to have pleasure at work?
I think it would be ideal to have pleasure at work.
Of course.
And what we found is that these kind of psychosocial connections are the strongest predictor of well-being from pleasure. So one of the questions was, you know, how much do you enjoy the company of friends at work? So this is an ideal thing if you can swing it. You know, we got pretty high employment at the moment, so I'd encourage people if they really hate their job, try and change. But of course there are times where we have to pay the bills and we may not like what we're doing, in which case if you can't find that pleasure at work, then at least, as Mike says, take your breaks and your holidays and look for more outside. And really this is where we need to very much, very intentionally engineer opportunities for pleasure and fun into our days. Put it in your diary. Set a reminder on your phone, because everybody listening tonight is thinking, yeah, I kind of know that, but are you actually doing it? So it's that step from knowledge to practice that is the one that makes all the difference.
Mike, is the idea of taking, maybe this is why, I don't know, the US work culture is, as you say, so obsessed with turning up and working all the time and not taking holidays. Is the idea that the idea of pleasure is such a solitary thing that it's seen as inherently selfish?
I think that's certainly part of it. What I've been able to unpack, this is more anecdotal evidence than empirical evidence, but it's this really interesting sort of idea of productivity that when, especially Americans, you know, do go off to enjoy leisure, they're worried about letting down their colleagues, where, you know, countries in the EU, quite the opposite, their colleagues are celebrating the fact that they're taking vacation and will indicate, hey, I have your back, you know, forward all of your emails to me. I'll make sure when you get back to your desk, you don't, you know, have anything waiting for you. Where in North America, you come back to your desk and you get to sift through the 500 emails that you missed during your vacation. And so, you know, releasing yourself from that cognitive load, we know, you know, Desiree touched on this, is so important with regards to renewal, building resilience, understanding that you do have, you know, these opportunities for respite that are so important for not just psychological well-being, but we know that the limbic system is, you know, that has these requirements with regards to reducing stress from time to time. And so it becomes important in all sorts of contexts, yet because of the social norms here, yes, you know, guilt is certainly part of the story, because you feel like you're letting your colleagues down. And again, that's just a maladaptive social norm that I think we're working on. One of the things that we really are looking at other countries, something that I talk about and champion, is the fact that France has now made it illegal for companies that don't need to operate on the weekends to run their email servers after 5 p.m. on a Friday, which really sets that social norm that, like, look, the weekends are meant for doing non-work things. And so you're not going to get a work email after 5 p.m. on a Friday, and you won't need to worry about it till you show up again on Monday. So creating kind of, you know, again, those safety mechanisms from the top are important. And then I also think as individuals, you know, relearning the fact that fun can coexist quite well with productivity. In fact, again, if you look at the literature, paradoxically, the folks that are having fun are the most productive.
Yeah, this is important to underline. That's right. If you're having fun, you're also productive. Desiree, what happens to our brain when we experience pleasure, and do men and women experience that differently?
There's more variability within those groups than between them, for men and women. So individuals experience things quite differently, and pleasure is an extremely subjective, you know, exquisitely subjective. There's nothing that everybody sort of likes equally. But what happens is just, and I know we're running out of time, so I'll just say it in a really oversimplified way. Experiencing pleasure downregulates the stress response.
Right.
That's what it does. And this is, you know, a point that I really want to make to your listeners is that it's as much as I'm saying frivolity is great, it's not simply about frivolity. It's about this is a practice that can boost your mental and physical health, increase your immune response, and just make you a lot nicer person.
Mike, can too much fun be a bad thing? And do we often mix up fun with hedonism or debauchery, for example?
Yeah, so in the literature, that's where it gets, we talk about hedonic tone, and then that oftentimes gets conflated, right, with this philosophical understanding of hedonism, which is, you know, a philosophy. It's not, you know, having fun per se, right? Again, because I know we're running out of time, there's an amazing piece of research out of UCLA. The professor is Dr. Cassie Holmes, and she essentially found the Goldilocks spot for hedonic pleasure, and it's about 2 to 5 hours. So if you're not finding, you know, at least 2 hours out of your day that are enjoyable, it's likely that, you know, some of these ill consequences that Desiree talked about, you know, might start to bubble up. But once you get past 5 hours, especially if it's a whimsical fun, that's when you start to lose connection to purpose, and that can also have some ill effects. So it's funny that people get hung up on this, right? Because sleep, we understand well, right? You need about 7 to 9, and people seem to understand that. But whenever you talk about fun, you know, it seems to be sort of this Boleyn, like, oh, they're just saying I need to have fun all the time, or, you know, I need to be a stoic. And that's not the case. It's really that just because we've gotten so busy, so many folks aren't having fun, and there are all these ill consequences. So again, we just need to sort of reframe the idea that, no, this needs to be a part of your life. But yet we're not prescribing, again, that you go to music festivals every weekend.
That's right. As we know, listening to music can be fun, but listening to it for 10 hours at a stretch might not be fun.
Absolutely.
Desiree, how do we build it into our lives? How do we make it part of our lives then?
I think giving it the respect that it deserves, and making commitments with friends, is a great way to start. If you're not getting much fun, try to make a commitment with someone else. It's like getting exercise, right? If we're really sedentary, a good way to start is to say to somebody, right, let's walk twice a week or something like that. So that's one way. But in remembering things that we used to love to do and don't do anymore is another way to start. And if anybody needs more tips, they can email me.
Mike, what do you think? How do we make it?
In behavioral science, we call that pre-commitment and pre-contemplation. And so, you know, building out your fun file, so that you have this premeditation, so you don't have to think about it. You know, I don't know I assume you guys have spring break there just like we have in the States.
Yeah.
I see so many parents that kind of just let this, you know, amazing week pass them by because they haven't really thought about what they might do. And so having those ideas in advance and doing a little pre-work is important. And what we know, because, you know, again, you can use these systems that kind of work against you sometimes, like your Outlook calendar, to your advantage. You know, when something gets on the calendar, it tends to be immutable. And so put time with your friends on the calendar, invite them. So there's that kind of social contract that suggests, you know, we're doing this, and you're a lot less likely not to do the thing. I have this thing called the Rucker Play Model. Anyone can Google it really easily. And, you know, it's kind of homework, but you can do a 168-hour time audit of your week and just see where there might be opportunities to, you know, change out something kind of mundane like doom scrolling with something off of your fun list, and you know, and then just make it happen. It's that easy. That's the best part of this.
We're talking about fun and pleasure and happiness and how we build it into our lives and make it a habit. Because as Mike Rucker has pointed out, and so does Desiree Kozlowski, the research simply is in, and you know, people who have more fun actually tend to be more productive and more enjoyable as well. Toby and quite a few others are saying, does a lot of this have some, sounds like it has parallels with ideas in Buddhism too. It's an interesting thought. Desiree?
Yeah, sure. Look, a lot of people say when I start talking about pleasure and savouring, oh, look, this is really mindfulness. And yeah, I think there is an aspect to it. But if you pursue the pure Buddhist and you know, cultures have talked about this, or religions or spiritual practice, where you don't really focus, the idea is to not focus on the valence, so whether the experience is good or bad, but to just be in the moment without assigning a value judgment to it. I'm actually saying quite the opposite. When you're doing something pleasurable, focus on it, know how good it is, know how incredibly fortunate you are, because I guarantee most of your listeners are doing that when something bad happens. So we're here to redress the balance.
I like it. All right, look, terrific to have this discussion with both of you, and I do thank you for your time. Dr. Desiree Kozlowski is Chair of the Academic Board and Associate Professor at Southern Cross University, and ran the National Pleasure Audit in 2022, which interestingly, Desiree, I just observed this in passing, none of the top pleasures or fun and happiness things in your audit had anything to do with consumerism either.
So not a thing.
Not a thing.
It was so far down the list, exactly, that it's just not there.
Stuff did not relate. Thank you for your time. Dr. Mike Ruck has been with us, an organisational psychologist and behavioural scientist, and author of the book, The Fun Habit. Mike, great to have your time as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you, Desiree Kozlowski.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.